All right. Since I probably won't call you, talk to you by name, and just I will say your name in the beginning, and then I'm interviewing, I guess it's Yusuf Hanun, is how to pronounce it, right?
That's correct.
At Duke, and I don't alter the beginning. I always simply ask about where and when you were born, and if you could want to start there, just sort of talk about your family. And
I was born in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. My father was a physician at the Arabian American Oil Company, Aramco, and we were living in sort of the town built by Aramco to house families who came to Saudi Arabia to live to work there. And that's where I spent 4 to 5 years, first 4 to 5 years of my life, mostly as the first child. In the last year, I'm 4 years older than my brother. My sister is 2 years younger than my brother.
So you were the only one maybe born in Dahran?
I was the only one born in Dahran, although my brother was born in Beirut, but he came back to Dahran for
a little while
before we finally moved to Beirut. So he was born in that transition period.
And what's your birth date, just again for the record, more so?
My birth date, September 18th, 1955. So we moved to Beirut. I'm not 100% sure now, 60 or 61.
Mm-hmm. And why had your father taken the job with Aramco?
Well, that's my father is a physician, and he was originally Palestinian, but he had left Palestine in, I would think, the 30s, went to Glasgow, Scotland, got his MD degree there and training, joined the British Army for World War II because he couldn't go back to his country during World War II.
Because nobody would...
There was no transportation, basically. And he joined the British Army as a medical officer and spent the balance of the war. I don't know what year he joined, but he spent several years until the end of the war with the British Army, but mostly in Europe. And after that, I think he returned back to Palestine. That was the interface between World War II, 45, and the partition in 48, and he had to leave then as part of the evacuation, deportation, what have you, that happened, and the massive exodus that happened in 48. And I think at that time he went to Jordan, worked as a physician there, but then went to Saudi Arabia. So most of the 50s, I think he was in Saudi Arabia.
And this was perhaps it was a better opportunity, perhaps even more lucrative than practicing medicine in Jordan. Was he practicing medicine with the, in the Palestinian community there? Or?
In Jordan?
Yeah, or was this...
I really don't know the details of that. I know for one thing, he was somewhat politically involved in Jordan, and you know we still have the same king in Jordan from the 50s, and
Hussein.
And my father, after being in the British Army, went back to the Jordanian Army as a physician, and with some political discontent or something, he quit that job, and I think he from there he went to Saudi Arabia as a job opportunity. And maybe some sort of political conflict. Nothing serious, but something that probably he wasn't comfortable staying in Jordan for.
Now, again, without... I realize this is more about your father, and so it really is just background, but if I understand correctly, there is a very large Palestinian population, and I believe that Hussein has been allied with him in many... I mean, there's always been some tension, but between... I guess Jordanian nationals and Palestinians, but there's also always there has always been a political connection between the Hussein and his maybe staying in power or support or
yeah,
or is this not a
That's a good assessment. I mean, I think it's an important question because a lot of those concepts, I think, are very formative for me in terms of my political awareness. Mm-hmm. The funny thing about it is Jordan was, you know, carved out by the British and French after World War I, and there is sort of after 48, there was a massive exodus of Palestinians, so there's a big segment of Palestinians. I think now it's estimated at 60% or something. And then there is a 30 to 40% sort of the indigenous population of Jordanians who were either tribal people or the sort of people who live in a couple of cities there, Amman and another.
I guess I wasn't aware that the Palestinian population was then a majority within...
It is.
Wow. Okay. I knew it was a large segment.
Yeah.
But I didn't
it is a majority.
Wow.
The funny thing about it though is the king is not one of those endogenous Jordanians. The king comes from an Arabian, sort of from the Arabian Peninsula lineage that he traces all the way back to the prophet Muhammad, and. Again, between World War I until World War II, that family, you know, his uncle was prince of Iraq, and his grandfather or his great-grandfather tried to establish sort of an Arabian kingdom between Syria and Jordan and Iraq, and then his son became king of Jordan, and the other son, king of Iraq. And
right.
Hussein inherited his kingdom from his grandfather as a young, very young person. And he's been, you know, he's survived since then, which is pretty remarkable for the Middle East. So the king has sort of always balanced all kinds of opposing forces. There's a lot of intermarriage between the Jordanians, Palestinians, so now it's a very sort of, it's very difficult to distinguish, subpopulations there, except that there are different kinds of Palestinians, as we talked the other day briefly, in Jordan as well as in Syria and in Lebanon and probably in Egypt. These are the countries where most of the Palestinians sort of emigrated to after 48. I think, from my understanding, the Palestinians who were not endowed with either special skills or education ended up in the refugee camps, where they're still there. And so that defines sort of one population of Palestinians. And then another population of either the educated or people who had skills to promote defined a very active workforce, usually a highly skilled workforce, because the Palestinians apparently were and remain the most educated population in the Arab Middle East. And a lot of the business people, the finance people, the physicians, the engineers in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan were Palestinians. So there is that population. And that population, I think, mixed much with the Jordanian population in Jordan, mixed somewhat with the Syrian population, probably to a lesser degree with different Lebanese populations, because Lebanon tends to be more strictly defined along ethnic or religious background. So that's sort of my father's background. I think the main reason he went back to Saudi Arabia is... I think he was politically unhappy with Jordan, I think at that time aligning with Iraq in what was the Baghdad Pact. And him being in the military, sort of, I think he resigned and just left the country.
That perhaps his own political views were known and he would be no longer you know, make it any further, or would be in a very uncomfortable.
He would be in an anyway. Yeah, probably something like that. I don't think he was in danger of being imprisoned or,
right.
you know, hurt. But I think he was not just not comfortable with being part of it, I guess.
Do you know how he became involved in this? Do you know whether it was through his involvement in the war, let's say in Europe, and through, let's say, British connections, or do you think it was from family connections and his growing up in Palestine?
I think the latter, much more the latter. I think his sort of experience in Second World War enabled him to assume, I think, a top position in the medical branch of the army in Jordan. Because he sort of was uniquely qualified to that position. But I think his sort of political activism, which in retrospect, like many of his generation, was very naive and very impulsive, and was shaped a lot by the events that were happening in Palestine over, you know, the 30s and 40s and whatnot. And, you know, people just didn't comprehend what was going on in terms of the creation of Israel, the support of the West for that, and the, you know, sort of the major friction that arose between the West and the Arab Middle East. And I think a lot of that resentment and sort of denial led to very naive political activism that pretty much led nowhere. I mean, that's obvious in retrospect. But I think those were the greater motives for that.
And as you say, your family moved back to, moved to Beirut when you were...
approximately 5 years of age.
So that really to talk about Tehran beyond perhaps one or two very vague memories is really not...
Yeah, I have some, you know, I have some happy mm-hmm. recollections of Tehran. I don't know whether it was the atmosphere there, being the only child at that time. I think job-wise, my father was in a very good... Mm-hmm. I think he was the director of the hospital there, too, for Aramco.
And so this would have been a hospital for any type of foreigner. In other words, American, British...
Yeah, most of the foreigners who lived in actually, it's not Tehran itself. It's called Ras Tanura. It's where the refinery is, and where sort of there was this. From my recollection, it's like regular suburban USA. You know,
mm-hmm.
individual homes with a little garden, and then a supermarket, and all that.
Wholesale.
I do have some recollections of our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
One family was a physician from India. Another family was, definitely a couple of American families there, and one with kids my age. I remember those somewhat vaguely, too. So these are my recollections mm-hmm. of that. They were happy years, I think. But I have a feeling that my parents didn't want to bring us up in that environment.
For what reasons, or?
Maybe for sort of, I don't want to say political, but maybe social reasons. They don't want us. We didn't want us to grow uprooted, basically. In terms of. I mean, it was predominantly an American mm-hmm. cultural impact there. Mm-hmm. And that was, I think, became quite an obvious concern for them that I was growing up to be, you know, with English as a first language and with, not being part of an Arab culture.
And now... You say English was your first language. Obviously, it was spoken everywhere outside of your family, but I take it you were speaking, you know, Arabic at home, or although your father, of course, was, I'm sure, more than fluent in English. And
I would say at home it was mostly Arabic, but then because it was such a close neighborhood, you know, and everyone, the common language was English. So
and your mom, where did your father meet her, or what was her? I mean, she spoke English too. Then I take it.
Yeah. My mom is also of Palestinian origin, and her family emigrated to Lebanon in 48, and that's where she went to high school and college, and or maybe just college, I forget if she had finished high school before 48. And then they got married in the early 50s. I think it was more or less a pre-arranged, but sort of through mutual friends that my father was introduced to my mother, and they got engaged, and then they got married. And then my mom went back to Saudi Arabia with my dad. I think the choice of Lebanon to move back to over Jordan was dictated. One is, I don't think my father still wanted to go back to Jordan at that time, and my mother's family was all in Lebanon, so they decided to go to Beirut at that time.
And your father's family, had they?
They're now. If you want to get back into that kind of history,
not perhaps in great detail, but just a sense of how. You know, because of course everybody was uprooted.
It's funny because the roots of my father's family are in a town called Tul Karm, which is in the West Bank. But my grandfather, and they were sort of landlords and things like that, and my grandfather was their, export-import connection. Mm. And he was located in Jaffa. Sort of the port of Jaffa. So that's where he established his own land and property and residence. And that's where my father and all my uncles and aunts grew up. And very analogously, my maternal grandfather they're originally from a West Bank town called Nablus. And again was located in Jaffa for similar reasons, because both families apparently were landlords with a lot of whatever, orange groves and what have you and whatnot. And so the immediate family, it's very funny because the immediate families were translocated, but the rest of the extended families are still in Tul Karm and Nablus. Okay. So my mother's family went to Lebanon rather than go to Nablus. And the only way they could leave Jaffa was by sea at that time. So that's why they went that way. But my father's family went initially to Lebanon, but went back to Tul Karm. So they stayed more in the West Bank.
I think this is important. You mentioned that, actually a few things, and I'm just kind of guessing at this or suggesting that maybe this is some way of understanding, even for just for myself, so that this conversation can flow. More easily, that I don't want to. Well, it's not so much a class distinction, but you mentioned the fact that, for instance, quite a large portion of the Palestinian population became refugees. They really were not wealthy enough, or were not recompensed because they didn't have property. I don't know exactly what but that there seems to be a two cultures, let's say, or something like that, within the Palestinian culture, and that. For instance, this arranged situation between your parents would come from a pretty close knit and maybe small. Hmm.
I think it came about because both families grew up in Jaffa, okay. So they had a lot of mutual friends. So
this
isn't
such a planned or traditional way of doing things in Palestinian.
I guess my dad wanted to get married and he was asking around. I would think he wanted to marry a Palestinian lady. Because of his friends and both families growing up in the same town, that's how it ended up being.
And you mentioned your father, they're going back, when they left, so I don't know why I assumed going back. There was no place to go back to. In going to Lebanon and Beirut, there was a choice over perhaps Jordan or maybe even other places. Was there a job there? I mean, you mentioned there was some family there, your mother's family. It was just time to get out of Saudi Arabia, perhaps, in this kind of artificial American culture.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, I must tell you that a lot of the decision-making there, I mean, has not been sort of, you know, I wasn't part of it
and
anyway.
You didn't have,
yeah.
That's not been a...
So maybe also part of leaving Aramco was the fact that, you know, the job wasn't, you know,
go anywhere
or something. So I really don't know sort of the economical or the economic or financial aspects of those decisions. No, the first year or the first few years, my father started out on his own as a private practitioner. He chose a clinic very close to Palestinian refugee camps, so he could sort of cater to that group of patients. And he stuck to that throughout the remaining of his career. He did take an additional job with the UNRWA, UNRWA, which is the relief agency for the UN that caters for Palestinians. So he had sort of dual, he had
a private sort of practice.
A private practice and that, but both were heavily catered towards serving Palestinian refugees.
That may indeed be the answer to the question about why Beirut and or why Lebanon, because certainly, as far as I can tell, that the problems for refugees and the situation for Palestinians was more acute in southern Lebanon than elsewhere, perhaps, or than even the West Bank.
At that time, the West Bank was a very integral part of Jordan, so there was no discrimination at all. So the Palestinians who could, I think, make inroads into the productive strata of society in Jordan were automatically admitted on equal footing. The same in Syria, with a little more difficulty in Lebanon, but again, my father could easily set up practice there, so the obstacles couldn't have been very formidable. But there has been a political, I think also a political, not just an economic force creating those refugee camps. You know, the delicate balance in Lebanon would not have taken admission of a refugee community into it, which would have tilted the balance and the religious and ethnic balance and all that. I think also on a more global political sense, there was a feeling that all this refugee problem was very temporary, and, you know, because, I mean, they still, even when I left Lebanon in 83, they still lived in tin shacks, I mean, with the, temporary, even though they've been in it for more than, you know.
Temporary, but where were they going, you know?
Well, I think there was a strong feeling that they were sooner or later going back to Palestine. And obviously the political leaders were reinforcing that day and night, although without the ability to deliver on those promises. And maybe there was also a deliberate, initially subconscious, but maybe more articulated decision on the part of Arab governments to keep the refugee problem rather than assimilate Palestinian refugees. I mean, not just sort of to create imbalances. I mean, that was one factor, but another factor is to maintain that as a status quo, irrespective of the perception of Palestinians and many others that this was temporary. I think the governments wanted it in more sort of more political expediency to keep it as an ongoing problem.
True. Indeed, it is. Right?
And it is, yeah.
I guess with maybe this isn't appropriate to ask you with retrospect in the hindsight. I mean, you experience it, and now you've had some distance from it. So I'm not asking you to kind of recreate how you thought about it then, but I guess how you think about it now. And given that in many ways the situation is still, quote, the same, although things do change slowly, and there seems to be a chance that in a foreseeable future, some settlements and agreements will be made such that there will either be two nations or there will be some. What was your sense of, you know, when you were growing up, of what was going on around you? Was it a sense of, yes, someday your family or maybe you yourself would be able to, for instance, go back to where your family's roots were? Was this a...
That's a very loaded question.
I know.
Just want me to...
So take your time. Yeah, it's probably 5 or 6 questions, and I really don't want to narrow it or define it so that you have to answer one of them. But
I think a very... I think all that background has been, you know, very formative for me.
Yeah, you mentioned that. That's what I'm trying to guess.
Yeah, I mean, in one way, I mean, I think the 48 Exodus has reinforced in, you know, a lot of Palestinians' minds, and especially my family's, that education was their salvaging, redeeming point, that, you know, and education was always the highest priority in our family. I mean, no question about that whatsoever. So much so that in retrospect, my parents initially prevented us from engaging in any activity that could remotely take us away from, you know, from education.
So no playing in the afternoon. You came home and...
Yeah, that was for temporary, because I think my brother, sister, and myself, I mean, did sufficiently well, I mean, very well at school, that we bought our freedom, so to speak. But earlier on, especially with me, I mean, I was the one most restricted to sort of, you know, give up other things, whether it was piano lessons or whatever. But, you know, as we proved ourselves, so to speak, and show that we can, you know, deal with school and education, we bought our freedom. So when, you know, high school and whatnot, I mean...
As long as you brought home good grades,
perhaps. There was no problem whatsoever. Actually, the funny part is education was so much emphasized that almost nothing else mattered. So I could do whatever I wanted to do as long as my grades were top-notch.
So it wasn't that you needed to learn how to play the piano. If that's what you wanted to do, or play tennis, or...
Yeah.
I'm just picking things out of the air. I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so there was no attempt at religious education. There was no attempt at even modifying my behavior as a teenager, which at times, in retrospect, was probably quite nasty. Or
we'll get to that.
So education was an overriding concern. The other thing, so the political awareness, growing up in Lebanon, but definitely a distinctive feature of it is, because of the sort of strict ethnic and religious identification of people in Lebanon, you could almost recognize by a person's name where they come from and what religion they belong to. And because of that, you know, I don't know if you can sort of imagine how such a society would interact with a foreigner, which I was, basically. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I was not a Maronite, I was not a Druze, you know, I was not Lebanese, so... I was never totally molded by or taken by the Lebanese social structure. I mean, I want to bring that up because it's extremely different from the U.S. culture.
Yeah. And I don't know that I can, without you trying to explain, I don't know that I have anything to fall back on to say, oh, yes, I can.
Yeah, because in the U.S., it's very... you know, it's such a melting pot that it doesn't matter where you come from. It depends on who you are. In the Middle East, it's almost the reverse to that. It doesn't matter who you are, where you come from. The closest in sort of the U.S. would come to me is East of Eden.
The movie, right, yeah.
Yeah, the novel.
The novel, sorry.
By Steinbeck. And, you know, in terms of how a foreign family or family from the outside comes in and integrates, and how that shapes the development of the family.
Our history is almost wave after wave of different kinds of immigrants by this third generation or second, kind of, you know, from Europeans, Western Europeans over a century ago to Asians.
It's very mixed, and it's, you know, you really care here much more about who the person is. So in Lebanon, it was, so I could sense, I guess, going back to your political question, I could always sense that I was different, because I was considered a little different. Now, grant you, there were many ameliorating factors to that, so I never felt like rejected. It's not a feeling of rejection, because there were, I am Sunni Muslim, so I could be considered part of that.
Mm-hmm. And even among Muslims in Lebanon, right, the Shiite.
The Shiites now are the majority, but back then, who knows? I mean, definitely the Sunnis had more political clout. There were many other sort of Palestinians, mostly maybe Christians, but also some Muslims, who were sort of in a similar situation. So there were other kids in my school with similar backgrounds. So I wasn't really an outcast or rejected. It was just different. I wasn't Lebanese. There was always, you know, this question of, what's going to happen to Palestinians over time, this uncertainty, that was obvious at home. And I grew up with that. And as I mentioned before, that the expectation that pretty soon we'll be going back. And the turning point came, at least to me, in 67, when there was such a hype built up by Nasser that, hey, that's going to be solved. And we're going to confront the Israelis and the French and the Brit and whatever, and just solve this problem. And in retrospect, it looks like he was totally suckered into it. And overnight, reality hit home, and I was only 11 something at that time. Reality hit that that kind of political demagoguery wasn't gonna solve the problem, and that the problem was much more fundamental than that.
This is also maybe a point of realization for many Palestinians that Israel was perhaps more.
Stronger,
long term.
It wasn't a temporary wrinkle in the history of the region. No Israel for 2,000 years, and then there's going to be no Israel for the next 2,000 years. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a wrinkle. And that was a reality to be confronted with. Although I would say at the population level, that did not go much further than that in terms of, that's a more severe case than we thought, but it didn't translate into, let's see how we can solve it and deal with it. Obviously, the Israelis at that time didn't want to make it any easier either by, coming out victorious. Golda Meir said, who are the Palestinians? I mean, they were not in the mood of accommodating. Right. At that time, therefore the reaction was, the growth of the Palestinian radical movements and the armed resistance movements. That was a direct outcome of the 1967 war, but to me it was an eye-opener that the infrastructure to deal with, aspirations of Palestinians or Arabs was just not there. It wasn't a mere change in leadership or in the political program. The education wasn't there, the understanding wasn't there, how to deal with this situation. I mean, people were in the mindset where we're going to ignore this problem until it goes away, until 67. So basically refusing to acknowledge that Israel exists. I mean, other than what you hear about in terms of Arab states not recognizing Israel, that's a political maneuver. But even at the level of, people refusing to hear Israeli news or acknowledge that Israel existed. It was a nightmare that was going to go away. After 67, this nightmare is not going to go away. And but I mean, the reaction was still very immature in terms of, you know, how do we deal with that? And as I said, you know, the Israeli political system at that time wasn't in any compromising mood either. So it just resulted in armed conflict.
One other area in kind of asking rather, I guess, undefined or series of questions in one question I had was also certainly on this political level and your awareness of it. And it must have been quite striking for an 11-year-old. I mean, really, I mean, although, again, you've got the hindsight of being an adult and a longer other events happening to be able to filter that, those feelings and emotions through. I also was, I guess, hoping to get some sense of the community you were in and so for, you know, yourself, those kinds of experiences. Like somebody at school and things like that. You mentioned when we met last Friday, just kind of got acquainted, that there really was, although it was a small part of Beirut, there was a part of Beirut where everything was mixed, where it didn't matter what your religious background was and your family background or ethnic background.
Yeah.
And I assume that this is also was true maybe in school and on the streets and in the cafe. I mean, that this was a...
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, I grew up in what's called Ras Beirut, and this is sort of like a peninsula to the west of Beirut, surrounded by the Mediterranean from pretty much three sides of it. It's really centered around the American University of Beirut, the hospital of the university, and the school I went to was an offshoot of the American University, and was structured very much the same way, run by, as we talked the other time, run by an American Board of Trustees out of New York, and the president was American, invariably. Most of the senior administration were American. It was a very, again, by relative terminology, it was a liberal education and totally non-denominational. And the whole area of Ras Beirut, I mean, was very unique, very cosmopolitan when I was growing up. I mean, Beirut was the financial capital and the intellectual capital and the political capital for the Middle East, basically, and a very good transition between Europe and sort of an interface between Europe and the rest of the Middle East, especially at that time the oil-rich countries were starting to want to access the West, and really Lebanon was at the interface of that. And when you say that, usually when you say Lebanon, it's really Beirut, and when you say Beirut, it was really that segment of Beirut. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of the central nervous system of the whole operation there, and it was very cosmopolitan, very mixed. I think in terms of Lebanese, it was equally mixed, you know, Christian and Muslim. And as I told you the other day, the Christians in Ras Beirut didn't leave during the civil war, so it was a very tolerant mixed population. And there were a lot of sort of the Palestinian class of the educated Palestinian people. So when I went to school, I had all kinds of friends from all sources, you know, all facets of middle class Lebanon or middle to upper middle class Lebanon, and it resulted in a very interwoven social fabric, because when you grow up with one group, one cohort of classmates, and you know their brothers and sisters and families and other acquaintances, and you get to know directly or indirectly almost everyone there, which is a very sizable number. I mean,
do you think you could just give a rough estimate? I mean, we know this is not exact, and
I would say it's in the several thousands. And
they would know who you were, again, just simply by some sort of, oh, that's so-and-so's son, right, even if they hadn't ever...
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Exactly.
And this is, again, you say Christian and
yeah.
Muslim and Palestinian and Lebanese.
Yeah.
And,
I mean, you could easily make all those associations, like, you know, if someone didn't know my parents, they may know, like, who my aunt was married to or their family. I mean, you could almost immediately, when you're introduced to someone, find common acquaintances or even relations. And this very extended social fabric is very different than what you have in this country. Very different. I bring it up because I can see how Americans cannot see that. It's extremely different. Ras Beirut was bigger than Durham. Yet I probably know 100th, relatively, the number of people in Durham than in the social interactions were different. I mean, if you went to the gas station, and you would in a year, because things don't change, people don't move. Mm-hmm. You get to know those people, and you know the people they know, and the same about the people who run a restaurant and the people who run a store. And I mean, you get to know those people at a personal level too. So the social fabric was very different.
Is this something that you still have? I mean, is it even given all that's happened in Beirut since, I mean, now we're talking, is you're going to school, perhaps even kind of what we would call in this country junior high or high school. You know, we're talking up into the end of the 60s and well into the 70s, I assume.
Correct.
Things changed quite a bit even at that time, but then, you know, certainly since you've... I mean, even before you left in 83, I mean, but there's still this kind of,
Does it still exist, or is it in my consciousness? Which way are you implying?
I guess maybe I'm asking about both. But
both.
Let's pick one and say your conscious, something you miss, for instance.
Yeah, it's absolutely.
And wish that your children would have here, let's
say. It's something I miss. It's something my wife misses, because she grew up in pretty much the same, although she's American-born, but she grew up pretty much in the same environment. I don't know if I wish it on my children or not. I would have liked for them to be sort of part of that. It's a very difficult question, what to wish for your children. I think it's a trade-off, and I think from my philosophical sort of analysis of it, I think it's a trade-off between, you know, trying to foster excellence and matching the best person for the best job and having mobility and therefore negating roots, or having roots and trying to find the best job any one person can do rather than match the best person. So you sacrifice one for the other. If you want to maintain roots, you don't foster excellence and achievement. Mm-hmm. I think that I sort of believe in that.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that you've come to realize, let's say, for instance, from your own career or your own experiences now as a biologist and somebody who actually is running quite a, well, we'll call it an operation, and I don't mean to be glib about it or flip, but, you know, it's quite an operation that's going on here, and you are in charge. And so that, obviously, you're looking for people who perhaps think the same way, too, who are, for instance, willing to move to Durham, who never have any connection to Durham.
Exactly. They move because they think this is the best thing for them.
And I take it that's why, indeed, you're here in Durham still and not back in Beirut.
Exactly.
Or maybe even why you left originally to come here. And
That's a pretty much accurate assessment.
I guess the other question, just for historical purposes or for the record, because we have somebody who's... experience is so tied up with it. What is left of this, again, I guess you see the part of Beirut. I don't want to try to pronounce it.
As Graham Greene said in, you know, a city without its people is a collection of concrete and steel. I think that's what's left of it. Most of the people who could have left have left, basically, and they're all over the world.
One more kind of, especially from the past Palestinian point of view, again, maybe one more exodus or something?
For the Palestinians, it was one more exodus. For the Lebanese, it was another, a new one. Yeah, and many of them are all over. Yeah, because that, you know, that's what happened in a more global sense in the Middle East. You know, the people who want to concentrate on their own abilities and to achieve and move on with their... I mean, they're always constrained by all this political, you know, just not just the fighting, but all the constraints that develop from that. And I see it happening in Lebanon and among the Palestinians, also among the Israelis. And it's a sort of a sad twist to the thing, because you're sort of enriching, you're depleting the area of the people who would be much more open-minded and tolerant, and leaving in place the people who are less tolerant.
We're coming to the end of the tape. Let's go over.